The AA Service Manual combined with 12 Concepts for World Service by Bill W., the 2021 through 2023 edition, revised and updated. Page one, the foreword. AA's Legacy of Service by Bill W. Our 12th step, carrying the message, is the basic service that the AA Fellowship gives. This is our principal aim and the main reason for our existence. Therefore, AA is more than a set of principles. It is a society of alcoholics in action. We must carry the message, else we ourselves can wither and those who haven't been given the truth may die. Hence, an AA service is anything, whatever, that helps us to reach a fellow sufferer, ranging all the way from the 12th step itself to a 10-cent phone call and a cup of coffee, and to AA's General Service Office for national and international action. The sum total of all these services is our third legacy of service. Services include meeting places, hospital cooperation, and intergroup offices. They mean pamphlets, books, and good publicity of almost every description. They call for committees, delegates, trustees, and conferences. And not to be forgotten, they need voluntary money contributions from within the fellowship. These services, whether performed by individuals, groups, areas, or AA as a whole, are utterly vital to our existence and growth. Nor can we make AA more simple by abolishing such services. We would only be asking for complication and confusion. Concerning any given service, we therefore pose but one question. Is this service really needed? If it is, then maintain it we must, or fail in our mission to those who need and seek AA. The most vital yet least understood group of services that AA has are those that enable us to function as a whole, namely the General Service Office, AA World Services, Inc., AA Grapevine, Inc., and our Board of Trustees, known legally as the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our worldwide unity and much of our growth since early times are directly traceable to this cluster of life-giving activities. Until 1950, these overall services were the sole function of a few old-time AAs, several non-alcoholic friends, Dr. Bob, and me. For all the years of AA's infancy, we old-timers had been the self-appointed trustees for Alcoholics Anonymous. At this time, we realized that AA had grown up, that our fellowship was ready and able to take these responsibilities from us. There was also another urgent reason for change. Since we old-timers couldn't live on forever, newer trustees would be virtually unknown to the AA groups now spread all over the whole earth. Without direct linkage to AA, future trustees couldn't possibly function alone. This meant that we had to form a conference representing our membership, which could meet yearly, with our Board of Trustees in New York, and thus assume direct responsibility for the guardianship of AA tradition and the direction of our principal service affairs. Otherwise, a virtually unknown Board of Trustees and our too little understood service headquarters operations would someday be bound to face collapse. Suppose that future trustees, acting quite on their own, were to make a serious blunder. Suppose that with no linkage to AA, they tried to act for us in time of great trouble or crisis. With no direct guidance from AA as a whole, how could they do this? Collapse of our top services would then be inevitable. And if under such conditions, our world services did fall apart, how could they ever be reconstructed? These briefly were the conclusions that led to the formation of the General Service Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous. Later, I will outline in more detail the events that have now become AA history. See Appendix A for the full text of this article. Appendix A, page 91. AA's Legacy of Service, Bill W., 1951. Our 12 step carrying the message is the basic service that the AA Fellowship gives. This is our principal aim and the main reason for our existence. Therefore, AA is more than a set of principles. It is a society of alcoholics in action. We must carry the message, else we ourselves can wither, and those who haven't been given the truth may die. Hence, an AA service is anything, whatever, that helps us to reach a fellow sufferer, ranging all the way from the 12-step itself to a 10-cent phone call and a cup of coffee, and to AA's General Service Office for national and international action. The sum total of all these services is our third legacy of service. Services including meeting places, hospital cooperation, and intergroup offices. They mean pamphlets, books, and good publicity of almost every description. They call for committees, delegates, trustees, and conferences. And not to be forgotten, they need voluntary money contributions from within the fellowship, vital to AA's growth. These services, whether performed by individuals, groups, areas, or AA as a whole, are utterly vital to our existence and growth, nor can we make AA more simple by abolishing such services. We would only be asking for complication and confusion. Concerning any given service, we therefore oppose but one question. Is this service really needed? If it is, then maintain it we must, or fail in our mission to those who need and seek AA. The most vital yet least understood group of services that AA has are those that enable us to function as a whole, namely the General Service Office, AA World Services, Inc., AA Grapevine, Inc., and our Board of Trustees, known legally as the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our worldwide unity and much of our growth since early times are directly traceable to this cluster of life-giving activities. Until 1950, these overall services were the sole function of a few old-time AAs, several non-alcoholic friends, Dr. Bob and me. For all the years of AA's infancy, we old-timers had been the self-appointed trustees for Alcoholics Anonymous. Fellowship ready for responsibility. At this time, we realized that AA had grown up, that our fellowship was ready and able to take these responsibilities from us. There was also another urgent reason for change. Since we old-timers couldn't live on forever, newer trustees would be virtually unknown to the AA groups now spread all over the whole earth. Without direct linkage to AA, future trustees couldn't possibly function alone. This meant that we had to form a conference representing our membership, which could meet yearly with our Board of Trustees in New York, and thus assume direct responsibility for the guardianship of AA tradition and the direction of our principal affairs, service affairs. Otherwise, a virtually unknown Board of Trustees and our too little understood service headquarters operations would someday be bound to face collapse. Page 92. Suppose that future trustees acting quite on their own were to make a serious blunder. Suppose that with no linkage to AA, they tried to act for us in time of great trouble or crisis. With no direct guidance from AA as a whole, how could they do this? Collapse of our top services would then be inevitable. And if under such conditions our world services did fall apart, how could they ever be reconstructed? These briefly were the conclusions that led to the formation of the General Service Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous. Later, I will outline in more detail the events that have now become AA history. The deliberative body known as the conference is made up of elected area delegates from the United States and Canada, now numbering 93, together with the trustees, the directors of AAWS Inc., and AA Grapevine Inc., NGSO, and Grapevine staff members, numbering 40 or more. The conference held its first annual meeting in 1951. Since then, it has met annually in April or May in New York. It has proved itself an immense success, establishing a record of advisory actions that have served the fellowship well during the intervening years of growth and development. Highlights of AA service history. To go back to the beginning, one day in 1937, at Dr. Bob's Akron home, he and I added up the score of over 2 years' work. For the first time, we saw that wholesale recovery of alcoholics was possible. We then had two small but solid groups in Akron and New York, plus a sprinkling of members elsewhere. How could these few recovered ones tell millions of alcoholics throughout the world the great news? That was the question. Forthwith, Dr. Bob and I met with 18 of the Akron group at the home of T. Henry Williams, a steadfast non-alcoholic friend. Some of the Akron group still thought we ought to stick to the word-of-mouth process, but the majority felt that we now needed our own hospitals with paid workers, and above all, a book for other alcoholics that could explain to them our methods and results. This would require considerable money, millions perhaps. We didn't know that millions would have ruined us even more than no money at all. So the Akron meeting commissioned me to get to New York and raise funds. Arrived home, I found the New York group in full agreement with this idea. Several of us went to work at once. AA's early money problems. Through my brother-in-law, Dr. L. V. Strong, Jr., my only remaining friend and the confidant of the worst of my drinking time, we made a contact with Willard S. Richardson, a friend and longtime associate of the Rockefeller family. Mr. Richardson promptly took fire and interested a group of his own friends. In the winter of 1937, a meeting was called at the office of John D. Rockefeller, Jr. Present were Mr. Richardson and his group, Dr. William D. Silkworth, Alcoholics from Akron and New York, Dr. Bob and I. After a long discussion, we convinced our new friends that we urgently needed money, a lot of it too. One of them, Frank Gamos, soon made a trip to Akron early in 1938 to investigate the group there. He returned with a very optimistic report, of which Mr. Richardson quickly laid before John D. Rockefeller, Jr. Though much impressed, Mr. Rockefeller declined to give any large sum for fear of professionalizing AA. He did, however, donate $5,000. This was used to keep Dr. Bob and me going during 1938. We were still a long way from hospitals, missionaries, books, and big money. This looked mighty tough at the time, but it was probably one of the best breaks that AA ever had. In spite of Mr. Rockefeller's views, we renewed our efforts to persuade his friends of our crying need for money. At length, they agreed that we did need more money, certainly enough to prepare a textbook on our methods and experience. In the late spring of 1938, I had drafted what are now the first two chapters of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Mimeographed copies of these were used as part of the prospectus for our futile fundraising operation. At board meetings, then held nearly every month, our non-alcoholic friends commiserated on our lack of success. About half of the $5,000 Mr. Rockefeller advanced had been used to pay the mortgage on Dr. Bob's home. The rest of it, divided between us, would of course soon be exhausted. The outlook was certainly bleak. AA, its own publisher. Then Frank Amos remembered his old-time friend, Eugene Exman, religious editor at Harper's, the book publishers. He sent me to Harper's and I showed Mr. Exman two chapters of our proposed book. To my delight, Mr. Exman was impressed. He suggested that Harper's might advance me $1,500 in royalties to finish the job. Broke as we were, that $1,500 looked like a pile of money. Nevertheless, our enthusiasm for this proposal quickly waned. With the book finished, we would be $1,500 in debt to Harper's. And if, as we hoped, AA then got a lot of publicity, how could we possibly hire the help to answer the inquiries, maybe thousands, that would flood in? There was another problem too, a serious one. If our AA book became the basic text for Alcoholics Anonymous, its ownership would then be in other hands. It was evident that our society ought to own and publish its own literature. No publisher, however good, ought to own our best asset. So two of us bought a pad of blank stock certificates and wrote on them, Works Publishing, par value $25. My friend Hank P. and I then offered shares in the new book company to alcoholics and their friends in New York. They just laughed at us. Who would buy stock, they said, in a book not yet written? Somehow these timid buyers had to be persuaded, so we went to the Reader's Digest and told the managing editor the story of our budding society and its proposed book. He liked the notion very much and promised that in the spring of 1939, when we thought the book would be ready, the Reader's Digest would print a piece about AA mentioning the new book, of course. This was the sales argument we needed. With a plug like that, the proposed volume would sell by carloads. How could we miss? The New York alcoholics and their friends promptly changed their minds about Works Publishing stock. They began to buy it, mostly on installments. Ruth Hawk, our non-alcoholic secretary, typed away as I slowly dictated the chapters of the text for the new book. Fierce argument over these drafts and what ought to go into them was a main feature of the New York and Akron group's meetings for months on end. I became much more of an umpire than I ever was an author. Meanwhile, the alcoholics at Akron and New York and a couple in Cleveland began writing their stories, 28 in all. When the book project neared completion, we visited the managing editor of the Reader's Digest and asked for the promised article. He gave us a blank look, scarcely remembering who we were. Then the blow fell. He told how months before he had put our proposition to his editorial board and how it had been turned down flat. With profuse apologies, he admitted he'd plumb forgot to let us know anything about it. This was a crusher. Meanwhile, we had optimistically ordered 5,000 copies of the new book, largely on a shoestring. The printer, too, had relied on the Reader's Digest. Soon, there would be 5,000 books in his warehouse and no customers for them. The book finally appeared in April 1939. We got the New York Times to do a review, and Dr. Henry Emerson Fosdick supplied us with another really good one, but nothing happened. The book simply didn't sell. We were in debt up to our ears. The sheriff had appeared at the Newark office where we had been working, and the landlord sold the Brooklyn house where Lois and I lived. She and I were dumped into the street and then onto the charity of AA Friends. How we got through the summer of 1939, I'll never quite know. Hank P. had to get a job. The faithful Ruth accepted shares in the defunct book company as pay. One AA friend supplied us with his summer camp, another with a car. AA makes news. The first break came in September 1939. Liberty Magazine, then headed by our great friend-to-be Fulton Osler, carried an article, Alcoholics and God, written by Morris Markey. There was an instant response. About 800 letters from alcoholics and their families poured in. Ruth answered every one of them, enclosing a leaflet about the new book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Slowly, the book began to sell. Then the Cleveland Plain Dealer ran a series of pieces about Alcoholics Anonymous. At once, the Cleveland groups mushroomed from a score into many hundreds of members. More books sold. Thus, we inched and squeezed our way through that perilous year. We hadn't heard a thing from Mr. Rockefeller since early in 1938, but in 1940, he put in a dramatic reappearance. His friend, Mr. Richardson, came to a trustees meeting, smiling broadly. Mr. Rockefeller, he said, wanted to give Alcoholics Anonymous a dinner. The invitation list showed an imposing collection of notables. We figured them to be collectively worth at least $1 billion. The dinner came off early in February at New York's Union League Club. Dr. Harry Emerson Fosdick spoke in praise of us, and so did Dr. Foster Kennedy and the eminent neurologist. Then Dr. Bob and I briefed the audience on AA. Some of the Akron and New York alcoholics scattered among the notables at the tables responded to questions. The gathering showed a rising warmth and interest. This was it. We thought our money problems were solved. Nelson Rockefeller then rose to his feet to speak for his father, who was ill. His father was very glad, he said, that those at the dinner had seen the promising beginning of the new Society of Alcoholics Anonymous. Seldom, Nelson continued, had his father shown more interest in anything. But obviously, since AA was a work of pure goodwill, one man carrying the news to the next, little or no money would be required. At this sally, our spirits fell. When Mr. Rockefeller had finished, the whole $1 billion worth of capitalists got up and walked out, leaving not a nickel behind them. Next day, John D. Rockefeller Jr. wrote to all those who had attended the dinner and even to those who had not. Again, he reiterated his complete confidence and high interest. Then at the very end of his letter, he casually remarked that he was giving Alcoholics Anonymous $1,000. Only much later did we realize what Mr. Rockefeller had really done for us. At risk of personal ridicule, he had stood up before the whole world to put in a plug for a tiny society of struggling alcoholics. For these unknowns, he'd gone way out on a limb, wisely sparing of his money. He had given freely of himself. Then and there, John D. Rockefeller Jr. saved us from the perils of property, management, and professionalism. He couldn't have done more. AA grows to 2,000 members. As a result, AA's 1940 membership jumped sharply to about 2,000 at the year's end. Dr. Bob and I each began to receive $30 a week out of the dinner contributions. This eased us greatly. Lois and I went to live in a tiny room at AA's number one clubhouse on West 24th Street in Manhattan. Best of all, increased book sales had made a national headquarters possible. We moved from Newark, New Jersey, where the AA book had been written, to Vesey Street, just north of the Wall Street District of New York. We took a modest two-room office right opposite the Church Street Annex post office. There, the famous box 658 was ready and waiting to receive the thousands of frantic inquiries that would presently come into it. At this point, Ruth, though non-alcoholic, became AA's first national secretary, and I turned into a sort of headquarters handyman. Through the whole of 1940, book sales were the sole support of the struggling office. Every cent of these earnings went to pay for AA work done there. All requests for help were answered with warm personal letters. When alcoholics or their families showed continued interest, we kept on writing, aided by such letters and the book Alcoholics Anonymous. New AA groups had begun to take form. Beginning of group services. More importantly, we had lists of prospects in many cities and towns in the United States and Canada. We turned these lists over to the AA traveling businessmen, members of already established groups. With these couriers, we corresponded constantly, and they started still more groups. For the farther benefit of our travelers, we put out a group directory. Then came an unexpected activity. Because the newborn group saw only a little of their traveling sponsors, they turned to the New York office for help with their innumerable troubles. By mail, we relayed the experience of the older centers onto them. A little later, we shall see, this became a major service. Meanwhile, some of the stockholders in the book company Works Publishing began to get restive. All the book profits, they complained, were going for AA work in the office. When, if ever, were they going to get their money back? We also saw that the book Alcoholics Anonymous should now become the property of AA as a whole. At the moment, it was owned one-third by the 49 subscribers, one-third by my friend Hank P., and the remainder by me. As a first step, we had the book company, Works Publishing, audited and legally incorporated. Hank P. and I donated our shares into it. We donated our shares in it to the Alcoholic Foundation, as our board of trustees was then called. This was the stock that we had taken for services rendered, but the 49 other subscribers had put in real money. They would have to be paid in cash. Where on earth could we get it? The help we needed turned up in the person of A. Leroy Chipman, also a friend and associate of John D. Rockefeller Jr. He had recently been made a trustee of the foundation. He persuaded Mr. Rockefeller, two of his sons, and some of the dinner guests to lend the foundation $8,000. This promptly paid off a $2,500 indebtedness to Charles B. Towns, settled some incidental debts, and permitted the reacquisition of the outstanding stock. 2 years later, the book Alcoholics Anonymous had done so well that we were able to pay off this whole Rockefeller loan. Jack Alexander looks at AA. The spring of 1941 brought us a 10 strike. The Saturday Evening Post decided to do a piece about Alcoholics Anonymous. It assigned one of its star writers, Jack Alexander, to the job. Having just done an article on the New Jersey rackets, Jack approached us somewhat tongue in cheek, but he soon became an AA convert, even though he wasn't an alcoholic. Working early and late, he spent a whole month with us, Dr. Bob and I, and elders of the early groups at Akron, New York, Cleveland, Philadelphia, and Chicago spent uncounted hours with him. When he could feel AA in the very marrow of his bones, he proceeded to write the piece that rocked drunks and their families all over the nation. It was the lead story in the Saturday Evening Post of March 1, 1941. Came then the deluge, frantic appeals from alcoholics and their families, 6,000 of them, hit the New York office. At first, we pawed at random through the mass of letters, laughing and crying by turns. How could this heartbreaking mail be answered? It was a cinch that Ruth and I could never do it alone. Form letters wouldn't be enough. Every single one must have an understanding personal reply. Maybe the groups themselves would help. Though we'd never asked anything of them before, this was surely their business if it was anybody's. An enormous 12-step job had to be done, and done quickly. So we told the groups the story and they responded. The measuring stick for voluntary contribution was at that time set at $1 per member per year. The trustees of the foundation agreed to look after these funds, placing them in a special bank account, earmarking them for AA office work only. We had started the year 1941 with 2,000 members, but we finished with 8,000. This was the measure of the great impact of the Saturday Evening Post piece. But this was only the beginning of uncounted thousands of pleas for help from individuals and from growing groups all over the world. which have continued to flow into the General Service Office to this day. This phenomenal expansion brought another problem, a very important one. The national spotlight now being on us, we had to begin dealing with the public on a large scale. Public ill will could stunt our growth, even bring it to a standstill, but enthusiastic public confidence could swell our ranks to numbers we had only dreamed of before. The Post piece had proved this. Finding the right answers to all our public relations puzzlers has been a long process. After much trial and error, sometimes punctuated by painful mistakes, the attitudes and practices that would work best for us emerged. The important ones can today be seen in our AA traditions. 100% anonymity at the public level, no use of the AA name for the benefit of other causes, however worthy, no endorsements or alliances, one single purpose for Alcoholics Anonymous, no professionalism, public relations by the principle of attraction rather than promotion. These were some of the hard-learned lessons. Service to the whole of AA. Thus far in our society story, we have seen the foundation, the AA book, the development of pamphlet literature, the answered massive pleas for help, the satisfied need of groups for counsel on their problems, the beginning of our wonderful relations with the public, all becoming a part of growing service to the whole world of AA. At last, our society really began to function as a whole. By the 1941 through 1945 period, brought still more developments of significance. The Vesey Street office was moved to Lexington Avenue, New York City, just opposite Grand Central Terminal. The moment we located there, we were besieged with visitors who, for the first time, began to see Alcoholics Anonymous as a vision for the whole globe. Since AA was growing so fast, GSO had to grow too. More alcoholic staff members were engaged. As they divided the work between them, departments began to be creative. Today's office has a good many group, foreign, and public relations. AA conference, office management, packing and mailing, accounting, stenograph, and special services to loaners, prisons, and hospitals. It was chiefly from correspondence and from our mounting public relations activity that the basic ideas for our traditions came. In late 1945, a good AA friend suggested that all this massive experience might be codified into a set of general, simply stated principles that could offer tested solutions to all of AA's problems of living and working together and of relating our society to the world outside. If we had become sure enough of where we stood on such matters as membership, group autonomy, singleness of purpose, non-endorsement of other enterprises, professionalism, public controversy, and anonymity in its several aspects, then such a code of principles could be written. Such a traditional code could not, of course, ever become rule or law, but it could act as a sure guide for our trustees, for headquarters people, and most especially for AA groups with bad growing pains. Being at the center of things, we of the headquarters would have to do the job. Aided by my helpers there, I set to work. The traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous that resulted were first published in the so-called long form in the Grapevine of May 1946. Then I wrote some more pieces explaining the traditions in detail. These came out in later issues of the Grapevine. Traditions took persuasion. The first reception of the 12 traditions was interesting and amusing. The reaction was mixed, to say the least. Only groups in dire trouble took them seriously. From some quarters, there was a violent reaction, especially from groups that had long lists of protective rules and regulations. There was much indifference. Several of our intellectual members cried loudly that the traditions reflected nothing more than the sum of my own hopes and fears for Alcoholics Anonymous. Therefore, I began to travel and talk a lot about the new traditions. People were at first politely attentive, though it must be confessed that some did go to sleep during my early harangues. But after a while, I got letters containing sentiments like this: "Bill, we'd love to have you come and speak. Do tell us where you used to hide your bottles and all about that big hot flash spiritual experience of yours, but for heaven's sakes, please don't talk anymore about those blasted traditions." Time presently changed all that. Only 5 years later, several thousand AA members meeting at the 1950 Cleveland Convention declared that AA's 12 traditions constituted the platform upon which our fellowship could best function and hold together in unity for all time to come. Medicine takes an interest. By this time, AA had found still more favor in the world of medicine. Two of the great medical associations of America did an unprecedented thing. In the year 1944, the Medical Society of New York invited me to read a paper at its annual meeting. Following the reading, three of the many physicians present stood up and gave AA their highest endorsement. These were Dr. Harry Thibault, AA's first friend in the psychiatric profession, Dr. Kirby Collier, also a psychiatrist friend and an early advocate of AA, and Dr. Foster Kennedy, world-renowned neurologist. The medical society itself then went still further. They permitted us to print my paper and the recommendations of these three doctors in pamphlet form. In 1949, the American Psychiatric Association did exactly the same thing. I read a paper at its annual meeting in Montreal. The paper was carried in the American Journal of Psychiatry, and we were permitted to reprint it. During the 1940s, two hospitals met all these urgent needs and afforded shining examples of how medicine and AA could cooperate. At St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, Dr. Bob, the wonderful Sister Ignatia, and the hospital staff presided over an alcoholic ward that had ministered to 5,000 alcoholics by the time Dr. Bob passed away in 1950. In New York, Knickerbocker Hospital provided a ward under the care of our first friend in medicine, Dr. William Duncan Silkworth, where he was assisted by a redhead AA nurse known as Teddy. It was in these two hospitals and by these pioneering people that the best techniques of combined medicine and AA were worked out. Since proper hospitalization was and still is one of AA's greatest problems, the General Service Office has retailed this early hospital experience along with the many subsequent developments and ramifications to groups all over the world, still another very vital service. A rash of anonymity breaks. About this time, a serious threat to our longtime welfare made its appearance. Usually meaning well members began breaking in their anonymity all over the place. Sometimes they wanted to use the AA name to advertise and help other causes. Others just wanted their names and pictures in the papers. Being photographed with the governor would really help AA, they thought. I'd earlier been guilty of this too. But at last we saw the appalling risk to AA if all our power drivers got loose at the public level. Already scores of them were doing it. So our General Service Office got to work. We wrote remonstrances, kind ones, of course, to every breaker. We even sent letters to nearly all press and radio outlets explaining why AA shouldn't break their anonymity before the public. Nor, we added, did AA solicit money. We paid our own bills. In a few years, the public anonymity breakers were squeezed down to a handful. Thus, another valuable GSO service had gone into action. GSO services expand. To maintain all these ever-lengthening service lifelines, the office had to go on expanding. GSO moved to 44th Street. Our present array of services may look like big business to some, but when we think of the size and reach of AA today, that isn't true at all. In 1945, for example, we had one paid worker to every 98 groups. In 1955, one paid worker to every 230 groups. It therefore seems sure that we shall never be burdened with a bureaucratic and expensive service setup. No description of our world services would be complete without full acknowledgement of all that has been contributed by our non-alcoholic trustees. Over the years, they have given an incredible amount of time and effort. Theirs has been a true labor of love. Some of them, like Jack Alexander, Fulton Arsler, Leonard Harrison, and Bernard Smith, have given much in their fields of literature, social service, finance, and law. Their example is being followed by more recent non-alcoholic trustees. As I pointed out earlier, in the 1940s, our headquarters was constantly overhung by one great threat to its future existence. Dr. Bob and I, our board of trustees, had the entire responsibility for the conduct of AA services. In the years leading up to 1951, we began to debate the desirability of some sort of advisory board of AAs. Or maybe we needed a conference of larger numbers, elected by AA itself, people who would inspect the headquarters yearly, a body to whom the trustees could become responsible, a guiding conscience of our whole world effort. But the objections to this were persistent and nothing happened for several years. Such a venture, it was said, would be expensive. Worse still, it might plunge AA into disruptive political activity when conference delegates were elected. Then Dr. Bob fell ill, mortally ill. Finally, in 1950, spurred on by the relentless logic of the situation, the trustees authorized Dr. Bob and me to devise the plan with which this booklet details. It was a plan for a general service conference of AA, a plan by which our society could assume full and permanent responsibility for the conduct of its most vital affairs. Birth of the conference. It was one thing to say that we ought to have a general service conference, but it was quite another to devise a plan which would bring it into successful existence. The cost of holding one was easily dismissed, but how on earth were we going to cut down destructive politics with all its usual struggles for prestige and vainglory? How many delegates would be required, and from where should they come? Arrived at New York, how could they be related to the Board of Trustees? What would be their actual powers and duties? With these several weighty considerations in mind and with some misgivings, I commenced work on a draft of a plan, much assisted by Helen B. and an AA staff member. Though the conference might be later enlarged to include the whole world, we felt that the first delegate should come from the US and Canada only. Each state and province might be allowed one delegate. Those containing heavy AA populations could have additional delegates. To give the conference continuity, delegates could be divided into panels. An odd number panel, panel one, elected for 2 years, would be invited for 1951, the first year. An even number panel, panel two, elected for 2 years, would be seated in 1952. Therefore, one panel would be elected and one would be retired yearly. This would cause the conference to rotate while maintaining some continuity. But how could we pull the inevitable election pressure down? To accomplish this, it was provided that a delegate must receive a two-thirds vote for election. If a delegate got a majority of this size, nobody could kick much. But if he or she didn't and the election was close, what then? Well, perhaps the names of the two highest in the running or the three officers of the committee or even the whole committee could be put in a hat. One name would be drawn. The winner of this painless lottery would become the delegate. But when these delegates met in conference, what would they do? We thought they would want to have real authority. So in the charter drawn for the conference itself, it was provided that the delegates could issue flat directions to the trustees on a two-thirds vote. And even a simple majority vote would constitute a majority strong suggestion. Delegates encouraged to question. The first conference was set for April 1951. In came the delegates. They looked over our offices, cellar to garret, got acquainted with the whole staff, shook hands with the trustees. That evening, we gave them a briefing session under the name of What's on Your Mind? We answered scores of questions of all kinds. The delegates began to feel at home and reassured. They inspected our finances with the microscope. After they had listened to reports from the Board of Trustees and from all the services, there was a warm but cordial debate on many a question of policy. Trustees submitted several of their own serious problems for the opinion of the conference. So went session after session, morning, afternoon, and evening. The delegates handled several tough puzzles about which we at GSO were in doubt, sometimes giving advice contrary to our own conclusions. In nearly every instance, we saw that they were right. Then and there, they proved, as never before, that AA's tradition too was correct. The group conscience could safely act as the sole authority and sure guide for Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody present will ever forget that final session of the first conference. We knew that the impossible had happened, that AA could never break down in the middle, that Alcoholics Anonymous was at last safe from any storm the future might bring. And as delegates returned home, they carried this same conviction with them. Realizing our need for funds and better literature circulation, some did place a little too much emphasis on this necessity. Others were a little discouraged, wondering why fellow members in their areas did not take fire as they had. They forgot that they themselves had been eyewitnesses to the conference and that their brother alcoholics had not. But both here and at home, they made an impression much greater than they knew. In the midst of this exciting turn of affairs, the conference agreed that the Alcoholic Foundation ought to be renamed the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this was done. The word foundation stood for charity, fraternalism, and maybe big money. AA would have none of these. From here on out, we could assume full responsibility and pay our expenses ourselves. As I watch all this grow, I became entirely sure that Alcoholics Anonymous was at last safe, even from me. Introduction, page 2. Welcome to General Service. The meaning of General Service. Today, there are approximately 2 million members of Alcoholics Anonymous represented in 125,000 groups spread across approximately 180 countries. More than 40 million copies of our basic text, Alcoholics Anonymous, have been distributed in over 70 languages. Indeed, AA has come a long way since the May Day in 1935, when our co-founders, Dr. Bob and Bill W., met for the very first time. So how is it that Alcoholics Anonymous has grown into the worldwide fellowship that we see today? The obvious answer is that many people have found sobriety through AA's program of recovery. But there's another reason too: general service. To those serving the fellowship for the first time, the term general service may be unfamiliar. From the earliest days of AA, Bill W. envisioned our message of hope and recovery reaching sick and suffering alcoholics around the world. After all, alcoholism is a respecter of nothing, least of all the borders between nations. And yet AA groups and intergroup central offices were not well equipped to reach beyond their respective communities. Their focus, and rightly so, was and is local. So in AA's early years, Bill and Dr. Bob assumed the overall leadership role. Yet it didn't take long for them to start to wonder, who will take over for us? Bill came up with a bold solution. The early leadership of AA would be succeeded not by new people, but by the collective conscience of the groups in AA. Bill proposed a plan to create a service structure to facilitate 12-step work across the country and around the world. This structure would bring to bear the collective conscience of the groups on matters affecting AA as a whole. At the heart of this structure would be the AA groups themselves, providing both the conscience and financial support for AA services throughout the fellowship. It would be a structure to take the place of government in AA, ensuring that the full voice of AA would be heard. Today, we call the service structure that developed from Bill's plan the General Service Conference Structure, or simply General Service. And there's a footnote 1 at the bottom that reads, Bill envisioned one General Service Conference serving the entire fellowship worldwide instead of a joint US and Canada conference emerged first. As AA continued to grow, other conferences formed, such as the General Service Conference of Great Britain and the General Service Conference of India. Each is autonomous and no conference answers to another, although there exists a spirit of cooperation. This manual is an outgrowth of Bill W.'s third legacy manual, which served the movement so well, beginning with Bill's first draft in 1951. It explores the general service structure that has grown up around us in the US and Canada and explains the roles and responsibilities of the trusted servants that make it work. All of the basic service principles and procedures outlined in that earlier document have been retained. An overall revision was approved by the 2018 General Service Conference, and the material has been edited and rearranged. It is, by its nature, a changing and evolving document. It will always be a work in progress, as it reflects the way our unorganized fellowship organizes itself around the ever-changing methods and processes of our vital 12-step work. We are never done finding new and more effective ways of reaching out to newcomers looking for help. And so as you embark on your own journey in general service, know that the fellowship as a whole works because of the time and effort you give it. Many who have come before you will say, it is the most rewarding service they've done. Given the worldwide fellowship that AA has become, due in no small part to those efforts, it's easy to see why. How general service is organized. The typical structure of many organizations in the world today can be visualized as a triangle. The triangle narrows to a point at the top where very few people hold final authority over everyone else in the organization. They decide what it will and will not do. The rest of the triangle, the broad foundation upon which the organization rests, often has little or no say. General service in AA flips this triangle on its head. The top of the triangle is now on the bottom, and the bottom is now on the top. Final authority now resides in the foundation of the triangle. In general service, this means the groups of AA. This type of organization is often referred to as the upside down triangle. The chart below illustrates this idea, and we have it on the screen for you. In this structure, the groups have final authority, but how do the groups make their thoughts and wishes, their group conscience, known to the rest of the triangle? General service is organized to do exactly this. Each section of the triangle has a role to play. How general service functions. The upside down triangle is divided into six sections. Each represents a trusted servant tasked with helping to make the conscience of the groups known. Known to whom? Known to the entities that occupy the rest of the triangle that are charged with managing the affairs of AA as a whole. It might be helpful to think of the general service as a kind of dialogue or communication between the groups, the trusted servants working on their behalf, and the general service office and general service board as they all manage the fellowship's affairs. Questions, concerns, viewpoints, and proposals travel from the groups down the triangle, and information and proposals head back up the triangle to the groups, and the communication continues. How this works is illustrated below, and we've put it on the screen. The group. The group meets to inform a group conscience on proposed changes or actions on matters relating to AA as a whole. The group's elected General Service Representative, or GSR, is tasked with 1. Making sure the group's conscience is heard and fully considered at the district and the area, and 2. Becoming part of the delegates' thinking at the conference. Chapter 1 addresses the GSR position in more detail. The district. Groups are organized into districts, generally collections of groups located near one another. The GSRs in each district elect the district committee member, DCM, who becomes part of the area committee. Chapter 2 addresses the DCM in more detail. The area. The area holds periodic assemblies that include GSRs and DCMs as voting members. Assembly schedules and agendas are based on local autonomy and group conscience. Information about them can often be obtained from DCMs or other area trusted servants. The area handles a wide range of concerns, and one of the most important functions is electing the delegate to represent the area at the annual General Service Conference. Chapters 3 and 4 provide more information on the area and its activities. See Map A for a map of the 93 areas in the US and Canada. And you'll see we've put that on the screen. The delegate and the conference. Area delegates make up at least 2/3 of the conference body. Other members making up the General Service Conference are 21 trustees, both non-alcoholic Class A and alcoholic Class B, directors of AA World Services and Grapevine, and AA staff at GSO, Grapevine, and Lavinia, bringing the total number of conference members to approximately 135. At the annual conference, matters of importance to AA as a whole are considered and discussed. Items approved by a 2/3 majority of conference members become conference advisory actions. They are referred to the trustees of the General Service Board for disposition. After the conference meeting, each delegate reports back to their area on conference proceedings and the approved conference advisory actions and additional committee considerations. Each GSR, having had the opportunity to hear from and ask questions of their delegates, is responsible for informing their group on the conference outcome. Chapters 6 and 7 discuss the conference in greater detail. The trustees. 21 trustees of the General Service Board, both non-alcoholic Class A and alcoholic Class B, have custodial oversight of AA's two operating corporations. AAWS Inc., which employs GSO personnel, directs GSO services, and is responsible for AA's website, AA.org, and broad publishing efforts. AA Grapevine Inc., which employs editorial and business personnel and publishes AA magazines, Grapevine and Lavinia, and other related items across its digital platforms, AAGrapevine.org. After the conference meeting, the trustees review the conference advisory actions and refer them to the appropriate trustees' committees, GSO or AA Grapevine, for implementation. The trustees report back through their quarterly reports on what steps they have taken. See Chapter 8 for more information on the trustees and the General Service Board. Page 6, Frequently Asked Questions. What's general service all about? The general service structure ensures that the groups in AA have a voice in the affairs of their own fellowship. It is this, and yet it is much more than this. AA was there for you when you needed it. The work you do as a trusted servant in general service helps ensure that AA will be there when alcoholics come for help in the future. For more information, see Appendix 5, Stimulating Interest in General Service. What's the difference? Number 2, what's the difference between GSO and my local intergroup or central office? The General Service Office, GSO, in New York provides services for the entire AA fellowship in the US and Canada. Intergroup central office and central offices exist to serve the local groups in their general area. Each intergroup or central office is autonomous and is part of a network of service outlets and AA contacts. While the offices are an important part of AA, they are not part of the general service structure or a satellite of GSO. The vital services they provide include maintaining local meeting information, providing meeting lists and other literature, maintaining websites with local information, and responding to phone calls and other inquiries from those seeking help. See Appendix S for more discussion on GSO and intergroup central offices. What's the difference between AA World Services, AAWS, and the General Service Office, GSO? It might be helpful to think of AAWS and the Grapevine as people and GSO as a place, the office, where the people in AAWS and Grapevine work. Many in the fellowship use GSO as shorthand for the entire operation and staff. How does General Service pay for its activities? Each entity that makes up General Service is self-supporting through voluntary contributions from the fellowship, supplemented by sales of AA literature. According to its charter, the AA Grapevine cannot accept group contributions and does not receive a share of any contributions made to the General Service Board. Its self-support comes directly through the sale of magazine subscriptions and other content-related materials. In relation to frequently asked questions on page 6, question 1, what's general service all about? It states for more information to see Appendix V, Stimulating Interest in General Service. That's on page 165, Appendix V, Stimulating Interest in General Service. Most AA members are primarily interested in their groups, in their own sobriety, and in helping other drunks one-on-one. And that is as it should be. While the work of general service has precisely the same objective, carrying the message to the alcoholic who still suffers, the connection is not always direct or obvious. Some stimulators are usually needed to get the attention of AA members to show them that service can add a rich dimension to their sober lives and 12-step work, and that their participation is vital to the future of AA. Good communication is of vital importance. In personal 12-step work, there is no end to communication. The sponsor talks with the drunk, speakers share their experience, we share with each other, but when it comes to general service work, communication has a tendency to break down. It can take hard work to get the attention of alcoholics, but with a creative approach, they can be encouraged to take time out from the nuts and bolts of recovery to think about another phase of their new lives. Once AA members are well informed about service, they often want to become involved and to take on their own service responsibilities. In many areas, the delegate and area committee members make themselves available to visit groups or district meetings and talk about general service. Workshops on the traditions, concepts, or other aspects of service are often an effective way of spreading the word of service. Sometimes two or more districts will work together to sponsor a service event. Here is the experience of two areas. We let committee members be responsible for running sharing sessions in their districts, then reporting on them at the monthly assembly. We created as many jobs as possible for GSRs and committee members and encouraged visitors to our assemblies so they could see what was being done. Video meetings. Altogether, we showed service and informational videos 239 times at group meetings. We had no records of the hundreds of questions about general services that were answered during that period. Reactivating districts. Frequently, there is a need within an area to attempt to reactivate districts or groups that have become inactive or are unrepresented. Areas encourage participation in general service in many ways, especially by direct contact with groups by district area officers to provide information about service events and opportunities to carry the message beyond the group level. Sometimes there is district-to-district sponsorship in which an active district shares its experience and suggestions to jumpstart activity among groups within the inactive neighboring district. And back on page 6, regarding frequently asked questions, what's the number 2, what's the difference between GSO and my local intergroup or central office? It says, see Appendix S for more discussion on GSO and intergroups or central offices. And that Appendix S is found on page 160, and it reads, general service and intergroup in central offices. What is a central office or intergroup office? A central or intergroup office is an AA service office that helps, that involves partnership among groups in a community. Just as AA groups themselves are partnerships or individuals, an intergroup central office is established to carry out certain functions common to all the groups. Functions that are best handled by a centralized office and is usually maintained, supervised, and supported by these groups in their general interest. It exists to aid the groups in their common purpose of carrying the AA message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Functions of an intergroup or central office. AA experience has demonstrated that intergroup central offices are helpful, particularly in populous areas. There are nearly 700 intergroup central offices throughout the world performing vital AA services. These constitute a network of service outlets and AA contacts to help carry the AA message. The following suggestions outline the basic services of the basic services an intergroup central office might offer. 1, AA inquiries. By providing an Alcoholics Anonymous listing in the local telephone directory and on appropriate websites, the intergroup central office may receive inquiries from those seeking help. They will refer the caller to a nearby AA group where sponsorship may be arranged or have a 12-stepper contact them. Many local AA offices now have their own websites. 2, office facilities. The intergroup central office can maintain a conveniently located office in which paid workers and/or volunteers coordinate local AA services. Meeting lists and other literature. At regular intervals, the intergroup central office may publish and distribute up-to-date list of meetings and other information about local AA services. Many intergroup central offices sell AA conference-approved literature for the convenience of local groups. 4, information exchange. The service office may function as a clearinghouse for the circulation and exchange of information among all the AA groups in the community. And this same connection, a logical function of the intergroup central office, is to provide exchange meetings, where group program chairpersons meet regularly to exchange meetings with other groups. 5, local committees on public information, PI, and cooperation with the professional community, CPC, in cooperation with district and area PI and CPC committees. The intergroup central office is an ideal contact with those in the community seeking information about AA. Thus, AA's relations with the public and professionals in the alcoholism field are often handled through the cooperation of general service committees and intergroup and central offices. To avoid duplication of efforts and other difficulties, good communication between all parts of AA is paramount. AA guidelines and workbooks on PI and CPC are available on GSO's website at www.aa.org. 6, AA and correctional and treatment facilities. The intergroup or central office can maintain contact with local groups in correctional facilities and treatment facilities, offering literature and pre-release AA contacts and arranging for AA speakers and visitors to meetings. When there is a corrections or treatment committee for this purpose, the service office may assist it through close cooperation with local hospitals and prisons. Intergroup or central offices handling institutional contacts can find AA guidelines and other service material on AA.org for shared experience in providing these services. 7, local AA events. An intergroup central office is a logical body to manage the details of an annual dinner, picnic, or convention if the participating groups wish it. 8, AA bulletin or newsletter, the preparation of a publication for periodic distribution to AA groups. Number 9, accessibilities. Many intergroup central offices carry information on groups that are wheelchair accessible or which may provide American Sign Language interpretation for members who are deaf. Some offices have equipment or materials for communicating with alcoholics who have visual and auditory challenges, those who are housebound or chronically ill, those who are living with the effects of brain damage or stroke, and others who may have less visible challenges. Communication. Communication between the intergroup or central office and general service area committee or the district committee and the GSO is the key to working together. In 1990, the General Service Conference stressed the importance of communication and recommended that delegates establish and maintain contact with offices in their area to share conference information and assure that intergroup central offices have a voice in the fellowship through their existing service structure. Try to find out what is going on by getting together from time to time with corresponding committees in your area. It is important to share ideas and discuss activities so as to avoid duplication of effort. It is not important who does the work, the General Service Committee or the Intergroup Central Office Committee in your area, but that the work gets done. That help is there. That help is there for the next alcoholic who needs us in our fellowship. Intergroup or central offices and general service area committees are complementary rather than competitive. AA operations. Both exist to help ensure AA unity and to fulfill AA's primary purpose of carrying the message. In 1986, the first AAWS Intergroup Central Office Seminar was held to discuss questions on literature distribution, pricing, and discounts, and to share ways to work together. Seminars are now held each year. Seminar history and information can be found at www.icoaa.org. For its own part, GSO also seeks to keep intergroup central offices well informed. As a regular policy, the GSO newsletter, Box 459, as well as activity updates and AAWS highlights are sent to each intergroup central office that lists itself with GSO. Therefore, it is important to remember to update office contact information. The staff member on the group services assignment is the liaison with intergroup central offices. You may contact group services by calling 212-870-3400 or by emailing groupservices@aa.org. Intergroup central offices and GSO. Common experience has shown that AA's worldwide unity is best served if AA groups maintain their own separate contacts with GSO. Direct group contact with GSO doesn't take the place of services provided by a local service office, but helps GSO to keep in closer touch with all groups. There are, however, some important areas of interest in which close contact between the intergroup and central offices and GSO is not only desirable, but necessary. Some intergroup or central offices, for example, like to be provided with new group information forms so that newly formed groups can be immediately listed with GSO. These forms, as well as forms for changing group information, are available on AA.org. Groups should not assume that if they list themselves with an intergroup central office, they are automatically listed at GSO. New groups are encouraged to send a group information form directly to the General Service Office, PO Box 459, Grand Central Station, New York, New York, 10163, or emailing memberservices@aa.org. Group representation at an intergroup central office. Service centers usually have no authority on their own account. They derive it from the participating groups. Intergroup central offices are essentially AA service entities, directly responsible to those they serve, as described in Tradition 9. Local group representatives reflect the group's conscience in the service center operations. In most communities, an intergroup central office committee or steering committee is set up to handle the administrative activities of the service office. The steering committee holds regularly scheduled meetings and deals with general policy and plans. And periodically, the steering committee reports to group representatives on intergroup central office problems and accomplishments. It is extremely important to keep a two-way flow of information going between the intergroup central office and groups. Source that's quoted, AA guidelines, central or intergroup office, revised 917.